You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Orla Chinoui once
Hello,
again.
Richard.
And we've got our guest this month, Abby Van Twisk from Drops Cycling Team. Hello, Abby.
Hello.
Welcome back, Abby. You were on the first ever cycling podcast, Femina. So we've come a long way since then. you've come a long way since then.
Yeah.
Have you had a good start to the year?
Yeah, it's been really good. Been to Australia in January and then team camp in Mallorca, just got back from that.
Yeah, no, you've had a busy start already. Yeah. A lot of racing already. So we want to hear about that. And your team has really stepped up this year as well. So we want to hear about all the changes and everything else that's going on with Drops, a team that we've been following very closely. This, we did cyclocross last month, didn't we, Orla? We're turning back to the road this month. We're speaking in central London. We've been this morning at City Hall at the launch of the Women's Tour for 2017.
Yeah, and the final stage of it will take place on the same route as the final stage of the Men's Tour of Britain, around the streets of central London, which is very exciting. I think it's a fantastic platform to have one of the major cities in the world closed off for a few hours for women's cycling. That's quite a strong message. It's taken a lot of work for them to do it. 3 years in the making, I understand, to get to this point. But yeah, 2017, the Women's Tour will finish in central London, which I think is brilliant.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll hear from Mick Bennett, who's the, well, what is he? Is the race director? Women's
yeah.
Tour. He's race director for the Tour of Britain, obviously. Has been for many years. He was there. We'll hear from him. Quite interesting, because they wanted the event to go up to 7 days this year, and that was blocked by British Cycling. UCI were keen for it to happen. British Cycling blocked it. Odd, but we'll hear from Mick on that. Part two, we'll speak to Abby about some of the Australian races already this year. And in part three, we'll look forward to the Women's World Tour, which starts soon with Strada Bianchi, which Abby is hoping to ride. She said she would literally die if she rides a Strada Bianchi. I don't know, before or during.
Not.
Before, probably, but I hope not.
That's not ideal, is it?
No, not ideal.
Abby's pulling a face, though, because she hasn't been told by the team manager, Bob Varney, yet. She's heard it from someone else on the team that she might be riding it.
Come on, Bob. So,
if you're listening, Bob, put her out
of her
misery.
Of course he's listening.
Orcs when I'm not riding it.
Orcs, I love it.
Put the pressure on. Orla, Energy Balls update. Oh. We're in a bar, so we don't... Bob, if you're listening, Abby is drinking water, yeah. Just to be clear. But
Richard's wife, if you're listening, Richard's drinking coffee.
Just... she'll not be listening. Orla, you gave out your Energy Balls recipe in the last episode, and they've been quite a hit.
Yeah, I did. And, okay, I promise this will be the last Energy Ball mention, because I feel like we've kind of hijacked the podcast with it. But we've had so many people telling us that they've made them, tweeting in pictures of them, telling us that they think they are understandably delicious. A few problems with people trying to take them out on rides. They do kind of just get squished.
This is where you need your science and sport products.
Oh, dear.
Mention to the sponsor. I'm a bit worried about, you know, all this energy ball hijacking when we're...
Well, I'm not marketing them or anything.
But you were being quite critical of some of... I mean, because on Twitter, on social media, when people post their pictures, you're all very nice and great effort and smiley faces and all the rest of it. But, you know, when the mic's off, you know, you're quite critical of some of them.
I wasn't critical. I said some of the almonds maybe looked a little bit on the chunky side, but... that was to lead me into a little bit of advice. My final bit of Energy Ball tip is, don't think that you're whizzing the almonds for too long at the start. Give them a decent old whiz, a minute, maybe even slightly longer, to get them nice and small so you don't, like, crack a tooth on any of them. So get the almonds nice and small, whiz them first, then put all the rest of the ingredients in, and then we're talking Energy Ball perfection.
Heaven. Brilliant. Thanks for that. We'll also hear from Amelie Diederichsen, the world champion. You spoke to her, Orla. We'll hear from Katie Archibald, who was at the Women's Tour launch as well. But let's hear, shall we, first of all, from Mick Bennett, the director of the Women's Tour. Here he is, Mick Bennett. We're in City Hall in London, launch of the Women's Tour for this year. We had Sadiq Khan, the the mayor helped present the route because it finishes for the first time in central London this year. What else is new about the women's tour this year?
Can I say, before I answer that question, what else is new almost makes this news almost pale into insignificance. But this is such an iconic and benchmark for us to finish the Women's World Tour event in central London. We said in year one that our intention is to make the Women's Tour, as it was then, the biggest and best women's stage race in the world. I think we achieved that in year two. In year three, we were given World Tour status when Tracy Gaudry and the then World Tour coordinator came to see us and asked us if we'd be prepared to do that. And I said, it's not going to cost us any more money, because what we do, and people have asked us this in the past, is how come it's so good? Well, I don't know how to answer that, because it's organised in exactly the same way as the men's tour that we've done since 2004. So all we've done is we've just taken the men's tour organisation and plant it into the women's. And they flocked over, because I think they were intrigued to see just what we were sort of promising to deliver on.
Yeah, I mean, when you started out, I guess you didn't know what the crowds would be like. I guess that's that was the thing that struck people right from the start, that the crowds came out in support of this standalone women's event. And it seems to have grown over the time. And I think that from your point of view, you know, it was a case of seeing what happened and whether it was a sustainable event. Do you know now, can you say now, that it is a sustainable event? I noticed that there isn't a title sponsor this year. Is there still a possibility of finding a title sponsor? Are you looking for one? And if not, is the event sustainable?
Yeah, it's no secret. We are looking for a title sponsor. However, we have a combination of other sponsors, some of them new, which will be announced shortly. We also have the venues funding the stages. So the model is exactly the same as the men's model. We don't have a men's title sponsor, which we are still seeking for both of them. But it's sustainable. We proved that right from day one, that it's here to stay. And we've got the venues that want it, the crowd and the public turn out to support it. And in London, with the mayor came to us and said, we want the women's tour in central London. And they're the guys that have delivered it. It was our idea, but they've delivered on it. And the venues are funding it for us.
I know you wanted it to go up to 7 days this year. That hasn't happened. Can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, the process that you went through and why that hasn't happened this year?
Yeah, we had the process was that we had that many venues wanted it, but not sufficient days to deliver it in. And we've got four other venues, if you count the starts and the finishes, four other venues. It's getting the date on the international calendar to give you 7 days. We'd identified two options for a 7-day tour, put it to BC. BC felt that the women's sport in this country wasn't at such a level that would warrant making the women's tour a bigger event. The UCI said the contrary of that. They wanted it to be 7 days. And then it was finding the slot to put the 7 days in. So then UCI had to support the sanctioning body, the governing body, totally respect that. And BC said only 5 days. The board of BC said only 5 days. Since then, at the World Tour Conference in Mallorca, the UCI have said, we definitely want the women's tour to be 7 days. Because I think it doesn't always follow that the bigger, the longer the day, the more stages in a stage race makes it by default a bigger event. 5 days with the level of organisation and the facilities that we throw at it, for me, make it a big event. And that could be 3 days. But the very fact that the country wants 7 days, the bike riders want 7 days, all the teams want 7 days, and the UCI want 7 days. And we're a bit baffled, to be honest, Richard, as to why British Cycling won't support it. They've given their reasons, and I respect them, but I don't agree with them.
That's a very, very curious state of affairs, that the national governing body has been the stumbling block in the event developing. What next? I mean, will you go back to British Cycling with your plans for 2018, looking to extend it to 7 days then?
Yeah, we have to apply by the middle of May. The UCI have told me to apply earlier than that because they are headlong and headstrong in developing the women's world tour concept on a global, clearly on a global basis. But they say they see the women's tour in the UK as the biggest and the best, and if you like, the catalyst that all others to follow. I've got the women's tour down under organisers coming over in June to see our event because they've heard so much about it. It's such a good advert for women's sport in this country and for British cycling. Why not extend it?
And I know, Mick, you'll be desperate to take it into Scotland.
I am desperate to take it into Scotland, but in order to do that, I'd have to convince you to turn up at each stage, which you're yet to do yet. And Event Scotland would have to want to do it as well.
So that was Mick Bennett. He's clearly disappointed that the move to 7 days isn't going to happen in 2017. It seemed last year that that was a fait accompli, that it was going to happen for 2017. It might happen for 2018. But British Cycling's reasons for blocking the move to 7 days do seem quite baffling. They don't seem to have perhaps the confidence in women's racing that seems to be borne out by the success of the women's tour more than anything. I don't think anyone who's been to the race or seen it wouldn't doubt that the interest is there, the crowds turn out, the riders are there, the riders are certainly capable of riding 7 days. So it's an odd one, isn't it, Orla?
Yeah, I think it's really sad when it is arguably the premium stage race in the world, attracts, as you say, the top riders in the world. That is when you want to maximise the exposure for the sport. I think it sort of highlights, maybe if you're in a bubble of positivity, as I tend to try to live my life, about women's cycling, you do forget the struggles that they're still up against. And there's this constant battle between pushing for progress and not being too impatient. But when I was chatting to one of the organisers at the route announcement, they were saying they had real difficulty as well with television coverage, international television coverage, and they were simply told there is no interest, which I find really disheartening and quite depressing. But I guess that's just the reality of women's cycling, and that, yeah, they're making an awful lot of progress, but for whatever reason there are an awful lot of obstacles still to overcome. None of which, or not all of which, certainly make sense, certainly in the case of the British Cycling one.
It's an odd one. Abby, fancy the women's tour this year?
Yeah, I would fancy riding it, but we've got a strong team of 16 riders, so selection would be tough. And yeah, but we'll see.
That final stage in London, though, you know, obviously central London very well. Your father's got a florist not far from the route. You'd presume he'd love to ride that.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Like, the Prudential Ride London last year was, like, roughly on the same roads, and that was so cool, whizzing around there.
Well, Bob, if you're listening, Abby's up for the women's tour as well.
We're sorting out
just
your
put me down for
here, Abby. I was like, let me have a break.
No, but it should be a great race. Again, and speaking to Mick afterwards, he was sort of relishing the prospect of an in-form Marianne Vos, who's still on the road back, I suppose, but certainly looked in good shape over the winter, taking on Lizzie Dagnan on our home roads, defending champion, of course. So
yeah,
a tantalising race and prospect, even if it is only 5 days this year, and still the possibility of going up to seven next year. I mentioned that I also spoke to Katie Archibald at the launch. She, best known as a track rider, of course, Olympic gold medalist in the team pursuit last year, as a lot of the team pursuit riders do. She's sort of breaking free a little bit this year. She's got a bit more license to do her own thing. She's not even riding the team pursuit at the World Championships in April in Hong Kong. She'll ride, I think she's riding the individual pursuit, and I think the Omnium. She wants to ride the Omnium as well. But anyway, I spoke to her. Here's what she had to say. So Katie, we're at the launch of the women's tour this year in London. It's going to finish in London this year, but you're still fully immersed in the track at the moment, I guess, with the Worlds in Hong Kong and in April being your main focus at the moment.
Yeah, somebody actually said to me today, they said, have you missed a World Cup to come just for these photographs? But no, so the team's out in Colombia at the moment, but I'm just staying here for a training block. So my next race will be the 6-day finale in Mallorca, which will just be a little hit out before, as you say, the big deal in Hong Kong.
How have you found it, you know, since Rio? First of all, I guess you had some time off after the Olympics. How easy or difficult has it been to get back into the rhythm of training?
Yeah, well, actually, I had a month off, went on holiday and things, and it kind of like it gives you the craving for a bit of regiment. I've got a lot more freedom with my training at the moment, so I'm the boss really. I'm choosing the sessions. I'm the main authority in what I'm doing day to day.
I mean, I guess for so long now, you've been, you know, part of a quartet or part of a Team Pursuit team. Not saying the pressure's off, but the pressure must be reduced a little bit after Rio. You must have an opportunity now, maybe this year, maybe next year as well, to spread your wings a bit, you know, race, as you say, as an individual, do your own thing a little bit. Has that, do you feel almost like, I don't know, D-Mob happy, like you've been let out of the institution in a way? Does it feel very much like that pressure is off in a way?
Yeah, like there's good parts and there's bad parts. So I guess the good parts is that everybody's winning, because the younger riders, well, the younger riders, the academy riders, a lot of my contemporaries are now having their chance to prove what they can do with Team Pursuit. So these are, some of them would have been junior world championships champions a few years ago, and yeah, now they can show themselves as senior riders. We're not hogging the stage, as it were. Also I get a chance to hopefully going to try and get selection for the Omnium spot, specifically training for the individual pursuit as well, and chance to experiment through the summer with the row season as well. So yeah, those are all the kind of the fantastic things of this post-Olympic year. And I guess the downside is that I really did love training as a team, and I guess, yeah, it's all about different flavours and different experiences, and I'm enjoying what I'm doing at the moment as well, and kind of test myself with different stimulus, I suppose, and I think it's working so far. Hopefully bringing some new successes as well.
Are you already thinking, you know, that you'll have these couple of years of freedom and then buckle back down to Team Pursuit for Tokyo? Is that in the back of your thoughts?
Yeah, so I guess the Commonwealth Games for us, so Commonwealth Games in 2018, they're being held in April because it's in Australia. So it marries in really nicely with the winter track season. It'll be just a little bit after our World Championships. So as well as kind of useful for us as track riders, Commonwealth Games, it also gives a bigger period between the Commonwealth Games and the Olympics. You've got a whole summer that we wouldn't have had the last cycle. So that's quite exciting. But it does mean that, yeah, I guess it's obvious we're already planning out how programs are going to look and how training phases are going to look all the way through to Tokyo.
You know, what does winning an Olympic gold medal do to you? Is that the main thing that drives you still, the idea of winning another one? Is that the thing that drives you more than anything else? Or do you feel like you've sort of ticked that box?
I like winning anything. Like, if it's an egg race, I'll try and get mine down there quickest, you know? Like, kind of makes Andy that can be motivated by so many different races. Like, I'll get nervous just for track league, and I'll want to do well just at track league. Don't tell anybody. But, yeah, the Olympics are the ultimate, I suppose, especially for track cycling. Biggest stage that we can really ask for. So I am motivated by Tokyo, motivated by the Commonwealth Games as well, to have a chance to ride as a Scottish rider.
I think you're somebody who loves racing, aren't you?
Yeah.
It's not surprising. I get the Team Pursuit, being part of the team it must be a great draw, but it strikes me that you are somebody who loves the cut and thrust of bunch racing, for example. I think bunch racing was maybe your first love, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, actually, we were talking about your podcast, weren't we? I think the first time that we met was Manchester World Cup.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was trying to make it onto the Team Pursuit squad, because that is, your point of glory for British cycling. But no, I think we even spoke about then that I've always really wanted to be a good points race rider, but I was always just very good at pursuiting. but yeah, there is that. There's a romance to bunch racing, of the marrying of tactics and form, that it's not good enough to just be strong, and it's not good enough to just be smart. It's got to be this, this combination of the two, this sort of gorgeous synergy of what I see as the pinnacle of the sport.
Because you were saying that after the track worlds, you'll be switching to road more or less immediately. You go straight onto road season, building up, I guess, to the women's tour, and you're in a new team, Team WNT. Tell us about the team.
Yeah, so first year UCI Pro. Really excited. This year it'll be riding with Graham Hurd as our DS, who I used to work with as the head of Scottish Cycling, and also with lots of the top UK riders. So we've got the national time trial champion in Hayley Simmons, the national criterium champion in Eileen Rowe, and various international riders. And I'm hoping that, yeah, we're going to make a fairly good showing as one of the best British teams. And really pleased to have a chance that WNT will ride in the women's tour and showcase, yeah, finishing here in London, massive cycling city.
I mean, this stage in London could be one that suits your talents.
Yeah, I've heard there's a sort of 6 kilometre finishing circuit. That's kind of racing I like. And yeah, certainly like to live up to a big occasion. So fingers crossed, yeah, I'd want to be there.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring Cycling Podcast Femina and also sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful to them for their support. If you want to get 20% off any Science and Sport product, an offer for our listeners, 20%, go to the checkout at scienceandsport.com and enter the discount code TCP20. That's TCP20 for a 20% discount. We heard before the break there from Katie Archibald, always interesting, Katie Archibald. A lot of people have asked actually for an interview with Katie. That was quite a brief one, but I do intend to go and do a proper interview with her at some point, a longer interview with her for a future podcast, so stay tuned for that. She's really, really interesting, and you know, if anyone has read her writing, she writes extremely well in various places. She's written a column in the Herald in Scotland, and she's got a blog that she updates from time to time. Very, very interesting rider indeed, very interesting athlete. So we heard from her. Before we go into Australia, I should say that we also did another interview this morning at the launch with for a future episode of the podcast with a very promising up and coming female rider called Maggie, didn't we, Orla?
Richard, please, you've already made this joke in this.
It's not a joke. Hang on, it's not me making a joke. It's just reporting a
me
conversation.
Me making a monumental F up, then not really, but yeah. Okay,
no, I got a text last night. Orla had set up an interview with a young rider called Eleanor Backstead, and she said, and somebody else coming along as well, Maggie. I don't know if you know Maggie, but
I think I said I don't know who she is, but I'm sure if they've suggested her to us, she'd have an interesting story. So I'll find out in the morning.
Certainly true.
To which, of course, Richard then replied, "Do you mean Magnus Backstead?" Cue fist to forehead. I'd already replied to the lady who'd set up the interview for us, saying, "Yeah, I didn't know about Maggie. You didn't mention her, but yeah, bring her along. Why not, Magnus Backstead?"
You were you're extremely tired. You've been working. Lots of days in a row,
yeah.
And it's an understandable mistake to make.
It's not really, it's a bit elementary.
He enjoyed it though, didn't he?
Yeah, he loved it. She loved it.
She loved it. Yeah. Huge hands for a
for such a delicate lady.
Anyway, that will come up in a future. We're going to do a sort of family special podcast, Femina, coming up soon with various interviews that they'll be featured in that. Let's turn our attention down under, because Abby, you've been... we're in... You said you wouldn't do that.
Sorry.
We're in middle of February, and you've raced... You've got how many days racing in your legs? About five or six?
Yeah, six.
Six, yeah. Because you were down... So you were down in... the mental arithmetic there.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. But you were down for the Women's Tour Down Under, of course, and then the Cadel Evans Ocean Road Race.
Yeah.
Well, just tell us, first of all, the Women's Tour Down Under, how was that?
Yeah, it was really good. It was a good event. It was made up of two crits and two road stages, so, yeah, a bit daunting. First race of the season, crits with, like, Australians who had been racing all year, but, no, it was really good. There were really big crowds on the crits and stuff.
You said it wasn't as fierce as some of the European racing.
Yeah.
As feisty.
Feisty, as in, like, in Belgium there's a lot of elbows and shoving of the hips and stuff, but it was fast, but maybe not as feisty, like fighting your way into corners. It was a bit easier to stay at the front and stuff, but yeah, it was still fast.
I mentioned earlier about I guess the eternal battle between pushing for progress in women's cycling and trying to be patient, and I guess the Women's Tour Down Under is a classic example of that. When you look at the guys' race, they all stay in the Hilton in Central Adelaide. It's a lovely setup. You were all in college dorms outside of town. The prize money's very different. No live television coverage either. And so that created a bit of a hoo-ha. But then the race winner, Amanda Spratt, said, well, hang on a minute, we need to be patient with this. What's your take on that? Do you think that it was disappointing that they didn't give more parity to women's racing?
I think in terms of like where we stayed, we went down to the athlete village a few times where the men were staying. And I know it is the Hilton compared to a boarding college, but I way preferred where we stayed.
Why?
Because it was really nice boarding college, and it was only us. And it was out up in the hills, so for training it was way better. But the Hilton was probably a nicer place to stay, and yeah, it is a bit odd that the men and women are so different, even though we're racing the same race. And the prize money is a bit, yeah, just, you would have thought it would have been more equal by now. But the actual racing itself, like, we got really big crowds and everything like that. And yeah, the racing was pretty much the same, so that was really good.
And you look at the Cadel Evans race, and it was televised live. It was the first time a women's race was televised live in Australia since the World Champs in 2010. Does it make a difference to you in any way riding it? Do you feel a greater sense of occasion in any way?
Yeah, I think you do. You see the cameras whilst you're riding up at the front and stuff. And also, it's nice to know, like, people back at home can watch you on TV, and then they're like, oh, saw you, that was a good move and stuff like that. So it's nice to know that they're watching you back at home. And, yeah, just to be televised, you can also watch it back, which is quite cool. Mm. So, yeah.
And the team, Abby, they've really stepped up this year. And that would have been your first experience racing with some of your new teammates, some of whom have come from big teams, you know, and it's a more international team this year, isn't it? How did that feel? Did it feel like a big change from last year?
Yeah, it did. Especially, as you said, the foreign riders. We've got, in Australia, we had Susanna. I call her Susanna. I think she gets annoyed.
Susanna Zorzi.
Yeah, from Italy. She's very good. Absolute beast. And we have Anne-Sophie from Belgium. So, yeah, bringing them in, they're very experienced. And Susie used to ride with Lotto, so did Anne Sophie, so they have loads of knowledge of like the bigger races and the classics. So from like all English, kind of like didn't really know what we were doing last year, to then having them and really stepping up, it feels way more professional, and we actually could make a difference in the race, like attacking and stuff, rather than just following wheels.
Do you feel the other riders are looking at you differently as well, because you were a sort of plucky amateur, unashamedly amateur team last year? You're professionals now. You're getting paid loads of money. but you're a professional team this year. Does that affect the respect, the attitude of the other riders towards you? Did you feel that?
I think so, yeah. Definitely the way when you're in a race, they look for you to, in Tour Down Under, to like attack and chase, help to chase and stuff. So I think they do think we're more on the scene this year. And, yeah, off the bike, everyone's very friendly too. So, and we've had a lot of compliments on the bike and kit.
On the bike and the kit?
Yeah, I think some are a little jealous, I'm not going to lie. So
I am.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
In 2016 saw a new innovation in women's cycling. I'm not referring to the cycling podcast Feminine, but to the UCI Women's World Tour, a collection of 17 events stretching from March to September. Next year there'll be 21 events, but this month I'm looking back to the World Tour's predecessor, the World Cup, which ran from 1998 until 2015. The first edition of the World Cup in 98 had 6 one-day events, and it was won by Diana Siluta of Lithuania. But I'm focusing on the closest ever series the following year, when Germany's Hanke Kupfernagel led Australian Anna Wilson by 18 points, going into the 9th and final round, the World Cup finale in Ombrak in Switzerland. Wilson either had to win the race or else finish second and hope Kupfernagel finished no better than fourth in order to take the overall crown. The World Cup finale was held over six laps of a hilly 20km circuit featuring a steep 2km climb and a tricky descent, which was made all the more technical as rain began to fall. The Australian team rode brilliantly for Wilson, closing down brakes and setting the pace until a decisive break of six got clear. Kupfernagel was in it, of course, and she and Wilson watched each other like hawks. But the pressure was on the Aussie because she knew she'd probably have to win in order to take the World Cup title. Kupfernagel was simply too good to finish fourth in a six-up sprint. There were two Dutch riders in the break too, and when one of them attacked in the last 500 metres, someone else chased, which gave Wilson the perfect lead out. She won the race and turned an 18-point deficit into a 7-point World Cup win, still by far the closest series in the competition's history. Wilson won the World Cup again in 2000, this time with her married name, Anna Millward. She's one of five riders to have won two World Cups. Britain's Nicole Cook and Lizzie Armitstead, now Deignan, are among the others. But in the competition's 18-year history, one name dominates the roll of honour, as she does so much of cycling in the last 10 years, and that is Marianne Vos, who won the World Cup five times.
Thank you very much to Lionel Burney. We heard there Lionel's monthly retro feature talking about the Women's World Tour. And before that, a message from our main sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful indeed to Rafa for their title sponsorship of the cycling podcast Femina and the cycling podcast. Thank you very much to Rafa.
Richard just popped to the loo, and while he did, Abby got some very exciting news.
I heard shrieks from the toilet. Shrieks. What was going on?
Should I share? I got added to the Strada Bianchi WhatsApp group, so yeah. I put two and two together. I guess I'm riding it.
Brilliant.
Riding well, that's
Strada Bianchi.
I'm very
happy.
Excellent news. Is that how it works? Is that you just get added to... You don't.
Not normally, you but I must have missed something.
You don't get told, you don't get sent a message, you are riding, you just get added to the WhatsApp group.
No, normally you get told. Like, yeah. Everyone had a meeting with Bob in Mallorca, but I think... Must have missed it.
It makes me wonder if this place is bugged.
Bob was listening.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Go away, Bob. Stop it.
Well, no, that's great news. So you must be delighted. Strada Bianchi is one of it's not an old race, but it's become an iconic race very quickly.
Yeah, it's just amazing, and finishes in that bit of Siena. Mm. That would be really cool.
Mm. And what is it about the race in particular that gets you going?
I think like the off-road gravelly sections, I love that. Like a bit of carnage, just go for it.
Do you like that? Do you like a bit of argy-bargy and a bit of, you know, gravel. Physicality?
Yeah, going down off-road bits, I love that. I mean, I did it once unintentionally in Norway. I veered off into some gravelly ditch. And then veered back on.
And you thought, this is for
I was
me.
Like, this
I wanna,
is great.
I want to write Strada Bianchi one day.
I want to do this on purpose next time.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Brilliant. Congratulations. And we'll be watching out for how you get on there. That leads on nicely to this segment because we're talking about the Women's World Tour. And that is the first event in the Women's World Tour. Just think, Abby, you could be leading the Women's World Tour after one event. If you can win in Siena.
Yeah. I mean,
anything's possible.
Silence.
let's hear at the start here from Tracy Godfrey, UCI's Tracy Godfrey. I'm searching. Is she vice president?
She is vice president.
And she's been the architect, I suppose, of the Women's World Tour. It started last year, and Hannah Troop did an interview with her at the end of last year, just talking about how that first year had gone and plans for 2017. There are several new events this year. It's expanded, not quite to the same extent as the Men's World Tour, which is like 37 events, but the Women's World Tour has certainly grown. It has actually been reduced by one event since the calendar was announced. Unfortunately, the Philadelphia Classic is not happening this year. There could be a replacement event for that. We don't know yet, but new events, Amstel Gold Race, Liège-Bastogne-Liège Ladies Tour of Norway, and the Bols-Rentel Ladies Tour in the Netherlands at the end of August. So, some really strong new events there, and I think there'll be great interest, obviously, in Amstel Gold Race and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. But let's hear now from Tracy Godfrey.
The Women's World Tour, it was a dream that we created 3 years ago with the new administration of UCI. The World Cup series was a very strong series. However, its narrative was limited to one-day races, which is excellent, but we needed to create a stronger product and a stronger platform for women's cycling. So the first Women's World Tour had 17 races, 13 one-day races, 4 stage races, from March till September, 9 countries, 3 continents. So it's creating a true world series for women's cycling. And the narrative over the year has grown and grown to the grand finale, which is La Madrid Challenge, broadcast on 190 countries around the world.
What do you think is going to be like the biggest thing you're going to work on next year then for the Women's World Tour?
So what we're going to work on is retaining the fantastic events, better coordination of the calendar so that we're not clashing with big events. As racing gets bigger, you can't avoid World Tour races clashing with point one and point two races. That's natural. But the important piece is to raise the level of media coverage across the board for the World Tour events so that they're all presenting themselves in the best way they can. We're going to be looking at the accommodation between the races and the teams so that the races are providing better provisions for the teams, because the teams are their assets inside the race. And we're using next year to help develop stronger team guidelines to launch in 2018. So next year is consolidate the World Tour event platform and develop a strengthened team model to implement into 2018.
And how far off do you think you are with the kind of the minimum wage? Because I've been speaking to some of the riders and teams today, and there's still a few comments about that kind of would be the next big thing, I guess.
Yes, and I invite that comment. I mean, as a former professional bike racer myself, so for us, we needed to build the platform. We're not at all shying away from the commitments that we're making for women's cycling and teams. The solidifying of the tour platform next year is where we are going to be presenting to teams what we call the cahier des charges, the regulations for teams into 2018, to create a Women's World Tour team layer. And next year is the year where the teams will understand the level that they will need to step to be World Tour teams in 2018. That will include everything from the qualification of the team staff, to increased anti-doping requirements, to the provisions and the provisions in the contract for the team riders. So next year is the year where we create that stronger team structure so that the teams are aware of it before it comes into effect in 2018.
And now
a lot to look forward to.
Yeah. How do you feel it's changed being inside of the cycling world as a woman over the last few years?
Oh, a lot has changed, not just on the bike, but off the bike. Whether we like it or not, I represent a big part of that change. That's been a lot of responsibility, but the great news is all the guys are working with the women. For example, the Road Commission and the Women's Commission working together. We've, across all of the disciplines, equalised prize money at World Championships and Continental Championships level. The fact that traditional men's World Tour events are saying, I want to hold a women's race, I want to put it on the same platform as men's racing. We've got more teams coming into the system, we've got more new races, and the broadcast channels are willingly broadcasting women's racing. And in other disciplines, we've got superstars in every discipline, and it just shows that women's cycling is strengthening in every discipline on and off the bicycle.
So we heard there from Tracy Godfrey, UCI Vice President and President of the UCI Women's Commission. She's been obviously very important in getting the World Tour off the ground. 47 days of racing this year, 2017. Certainly more manageable, the Women's World Tour, than the Men's World Tour. There's some kind of logic to it. Surprise that Het Nieuwsblad isn't a Women's World Tour event, but You look through the list, and you've got Strade Bianche, obviously, you've got Kent Wevelgem, Amstel Gold Race, Liège Bastogne Liège, Trofeo Binda in Italy, the Amgen Tour of California. Amgen.
When you said Amgen. It, I thought, is it not Amgen?
Amgen, sorry. That's why I'm trying to read sometimes. the Giro Rosa, La Corse, obviously, which is not in Paris this year, but down in the Alps, and And women's tour. So there's a mixture of, you know, top one day races and stage races. I mean, Abby, do you feel it's very much a work in progress, as Tracy Godfrey said there, and it's not something you can just launch and it's fully formed and people buy into it. Do you feel that it's something that gives women's racing a focus, that it's something that has already, after a year, got the imagination of the top riders and the teams?
Yeah, I think definitely. Because the men have had it always, and it's always work that's like a main races of the season and huge coverage. So it's a step up from the World Cups to the World Tour. So yeah, I think it is really good, and especially for like the main teams to battle over.
When you look on over that list of events for this year, I mean, we've obviously mentioned Strade Bianche and the women's tour. What are the other ones that sort of catch your eye?
I think Tour of Flanders is always a really big race because it's iconic.
I mean, what do you think, though, at least about taking the women's tour up these iconic climbs that we're used to from men's racing? You did Vont 2 last year.
Yeah.
And I read an interview where you said, yeah, it was brutal, but it was just wonderful to have ridden it in anger and to be sitting at the top and looking around the landscape. And I guess in a metaphorical sense as well, to see how women's cycling is coming.
Yeah, I think definitely going up these iconic climbs is a big step forward, because the men, normally it's just the men and the women are off to the side doing a little crit or like a flat road stage. So I think because we all have to step up our game. If we have to step up our game as well, if we want the coverage and it to progress. So yeah, I think it's good being equal.
Orla, you spoke recently to Amelie Diederichsen, the world champion. Shall we hear from her? We did have an interview with the Women's World Tour winner Megan Garnier a couple of months ago, and Amelie Diederichsen, of course, won the other major honour last year, quite a surprise really, in Qatar, beating Kirsten Wild in the bunch sprint. Young rider, 19 at the time, I think she was.
20 now. And she said herself it was a surprise to her to win. She's only had 3 elite wins, one of them being the World Championships. And she is several times a junior world champion, so it wasn't hugely unexpected, but in her words, she wasn't expecting it, certainly at this stage. I think what's really interesting is being a member of Bols Dolman, such a dominant team, with so many champions and so many people who can vie for a win across each of the races, I guess, that they enter. One of her teammates last year, said that maybe Amelie doesn't get the chance to shine as much in that team as maybe she could elsewhere. And with the World Championship, she's one of just 3 riders from Denmark, so she was very much the team leader, so it was all on her. And it was really interesting to see what she could do. I mean, races, you know, circumstances conspire to make a race the way it is, but certainly she was given a chance, she took it, and it was wonderfully exciting. She's still so young and very humble in her ambitions, even for what she wants to achieve in 2017 with the Rainbow Bands. It was quite refreshing to talk to her, but yeah, let's hear what Amelie Diederichsen had to say. I want to ask you about the World Championships, if that's okay, bring you back to Qatar at the end of last year. You looked a bit shocked, I think, when you crossed the line first. Were you? Were you surprised?
Yeah, I mean, I was real surprised. I've always dreamt of becoming a world champion and riding around in the jersey as an elite. But that I could do it already, I've never thought I could do it. So I was really surprised and really, really happy.
It's interesting that you say that you dreamt about riding in those bands as an elite, because of course that was your 4th world title. You already had 3 world championship titles as a junior. So you must have felt, I guess, in some way that this title was going to come at some stage in your career, did you?
I didn't really feel it was coming. I mean, I've dreamt of it. When I won as a junior, it was really huge for me, and I was, of course, really happy with that. But then, I became an elite and a senior and got to race with all the all the big names. And then, I kind of stopped dreaming about getting it for real. So people always people say, but it was only the junior. I'm like, yeah. But now it's not only the juniors anymore, so I'm really happy with that.
What was that race like? Talk me through it, if you don't mind. You were competing against the then world champion and teammate, Lizzie Armitstead, as she was, Lizzie Dagenham now. Kirsten Wild was probably one of the favourites for the race. Talk me through that that day in Qatar.
Yeah, we were only a three-goal team. So we knew we hadn't so many cards to play with compared to the other strong teams. So from the beginning on, I was a captain. I was the leader from Denmark. And if it came into a bunch sprint, it was me who was going for. We felt pretty certain before going to Qatar that it would end up in a bunch sprint. But then we saw the junior men's racing and thought, oh, actually can turn out differently. So we started thinking about, okay, what can we do if the race is going to be different than we expected to. But yeah, I'm happy it ended up in a bunch sprint and they could help me. Because as I was named the captain, they brought me water and stuff all the way through. And then in the end, I had to position myself and get it ready for the sprint myself. But for sure, I had their support the entire race.
Winning that race in particular, as you mentioned, you have been junior world champion already. But I think a lot of people, when they saw you cross that line, were a little bit surprised and thinking, wow, who is this girl? Where has she come from? You'd only won two senior races before then. And so it really projected you onto the front line of people's imagination. What's life for you been like since winning the Rainbow Bands as a senior? Has it changed much or is it too soon to tell?
I mean, my normal life at home hasn't changed so much. I'm still the same girl and I still live with my parents and go to school. So that way hasn't changed. But I can see, like, when I'm training on the roads and when I, for instance, come and watch races on the track, a lot of people know who I am now and wanted to talk and have photos and stuff. So in that way, it has changed a little.
You say you're still living with your parents, you're still going to school, so you're still studying. How do you juggle being the top rider in the world, I guess, with that kind of very ordinary life?
I mean, I had the opportunity to take the school over 5 years compared to normally it takes 3 years to do it. So I have done it a bit slower. So I have time for cycling on the side, and I'm really happy for that opportunity. And yeah, I finished this summer and then I'm gonna go full-time cycling, so I'm really looking forward to that.
And as I mentioned, you've only won three senior races so far. You're still only 20. Are you concerned in any way that wearing this jersey in the next year adds a little bit more pressure, whereas otherwise you could have been, I guess, quietly growing into your senior career, quietly trying to build experience and win more races without your name really being a standout? But I guess that jersey is a real target on your back now, isn't it?
I mean, of course, there's going to be a lot more attention to me now. People will know that I'm fast in the sprint, where before I could probably hide a bit more. I dream of taking a victory or two next season, and that's my main goal. It's not like I'm like I think now that I can win everything just because I won the world championships. I mean, it's as you say, it's my I have only three victories as a lead, so I'll hope I can take one or two next season.
Emily, tell me how you got into racing then. I believe that you followed your older brother into the sport, and you've got quite a lot of experience racing against the guys, racing against boys before, and now racing against the men in Denmark. What's that been like? Tell me about that.
When I'm racing Denmark, we always race with the men, mostly. Sometimes we have a few races with only girls, but I think it's a really good practice, and it's hard training to race with the men. And when I was younger, it was against the boys. So, because if it was only us girls in a peloton, it wouldn't actually be a peloton. So I think it's the only way we can do it, and I think it's a good way to do it.
How does the racing differ then when you're racing against the guys compared to racing against the girls?
When I was younger, I couldn't always keep up the speed, so sometimes I got dropped. But
only sometimes, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, okay, when I was really young, I always got dropped, but then slower and slower, I got better, and then, yeah, in the end, I could actually battle for the wins, and now I can also battle for the wins in the men's C class we have in Denmark. And yeah, it's funny because it gives me practice for finals and stuff also. So,
have you won many men's races or any men's races outright? I mean, what do the guys think about being beaten by a girl?
I think I won like a couple the last two seasons. So it's quite funny. I mean, now I think they think it's okay now after my title, but in the beginning they're like, there's a girl beating us.
Yeah, you've got a huge fan club I'm sure of all the guys in Denmark that you've ever beaten. At least if you've got the rainbow bands on your back, they'll think, well, okay, I can allow myself to be beaten by her now.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that they don't like it, but I think they're probably okay with it now.
I mean, where I'm based in the UK, we have quite a strong female domestic scene now. Would you recommend for girls to try to race against guys if they can, if that route is open to them? Do you think that would be a good way to develop as a rider?
Yeah, I mean, if there's no opportunity to ride against a whole peloton of only girls, then I think it's a way to do it. Because I mean, I like racing, and I like racing when there's a big bunch and attacks and everything. And that's the only way we can do it in Denmark. So
you've been with Bols Dolmans then since you turned pro in 2015. They completely dominated last year. 40 race wins. Of course, they won the World Tour, the first World Tour as well. I can imagine other teams and riders and other teams looking at you guys and scratching their heads and thinking, how on earth are they so successful? So, Emily, how on earth are you so successful as a team?
I think we work really good together and support each other. I think in a lot of races, actually, we had more riders who could win if they were on different teams. But yeah, combining all the strength and supporting each other, even though all of us are pretty strong, I think that's make a key to success. I mean, it's always only one girl who goes to the podium, but all of us helps, and I think that's we just succeed in creating this atmosphere that everybody wants to help each other, and I think that's really important.
As you say, last year you had riders who maybe could have gone for the win in other teams. Is that something that, I don't want to predict any downside to this, but is that something that could be a problem, do you think? I mean, we look at in the men's side of things, for example, a few years ago in particular, Team Sky maybe had too much talent and they didn't have enough, maybe there are only so many races in a year whereby any rider can go for the win, and so you're limited almost by that. You've got the former world champion Lizzie Deignan, we've got last year's World Tour winner Megan Garnier, we've got the Olympic champion Anna van der Breggen joining now as well. Is there a danger of the team becoming too crowded with talent?
I think, of course, there's always a chance that it won't work out, but I think that, we succeeded with it last year, and I think we're going to do it again this year. I think it will be hard to make the same success as we had last year because we had so many race victories.
So where do you think the main threats are going to come from then? Which teams in particular, and I mentioned teams rather than individuals, do you think will be threatening Bols Dolmans' dominance this year?
I think it's going to be really hard to see who's going to, going to be the our main challenger because of all the rider changes, but because they're also so strong, and I think maybe it's going to be more equal.
You'll maybe just see how it all plays out once the racing gets underway.
Yeah, because the thing is, you never know how people are going to kind of work together. But yeah, so that's going to be the main thing. If they can make it work, all the new team members and all the old ones working well together, and that's why, I mean, we have three new ones, and I think, yeah, if we can, yeah, get them well worked into the team, and then we can make some really good results. We already had fun on the training camps and learned each other more to get to know each other. Yeah.
How was that training camp? It looked fun.
Yeah, we've been on two so far. It haven't been all the girls on all the camps because, yeah, some are doing cyclocross and some live in warm places. But it's been really great. And we have stayed in this house in Spain and, yeah, cooked together and trained together. And so it's nice to learn your new teammates in a different way. And I'm really looking forward to start the season with them.
So, Emily, your first win then of 2017 has been in the track. Your goal last year had been the track at the Olympics as well, the Omnium, in which you finished fifth. And you've had this success, phenomenal success on the road. How do you see your future mixing up between the track and the road?
I hope to continue riding both the road and track. I mean, I really love the track and I also love the road. So I would like to be able to still combine them. This year I'm going to focus mostly on the road. But then I hope to pick up the track, maybe already next year, and then, yeah, ride both again.
So finally, Emily, 2016, a standout year in your very early career. How do you top that in 2017? What's your big goal for the year ahead?
Yeah, it's going to be a really hard year to top. With the Olympics and the Worlds and everything, yeah, achieving the result I dreamed of. But if I in 2017 get a victory or two on the road and, yeah, it's more consistent in the finals and yeah, and take it my level even higher, then I'm going to be satisfied.
And maybe go back to Denmark and beat those guys again a few more times.
I'll try.
Emily, thank you so much for taking the time to talk and thank you for persevering with it. I really appreciate it.
So that was Emily Diderikson. You used to pronounce your name a little bit differently.
I say Diderikson, but I'm not sure.
Well, what surprised me there was that she's still at school.
Yeah. Yeah, she's still at high school, living with her parents.
Yeah.
Because in Denmark, they've got a really special system whereby if you're an elite athlete, the 3 years of high school that it normally takes, presume it's like a form of senior school, you can, if you're an elite athlete, you can go on a special program whereby you can finish high school in 5 years, so you can progress as an elite athlete at the same time. So yeah, she's still at home hoping to complete high school this year as a world champion. So quite an unusual setup, but I mentioned before just how humble she came across. You know, she's hoping, she says, for one or two wins this year, which I think, as world champion, seems remarkably low. But, you know, she has only three elite wins to her name. But you would imagine that the confidence that being world champion would bring would propel her on to a few more. But as she says, there'll be nowhere to hide. People now know that she's pretty handy in a sprint. She was able to come as a bit of a surprise in the World Championships. No one's going to be surprised to see Emily Diderikson or Diderikson at the pointy end of a race anymore.
I think she could be more than a sprinter as well, isn't? Mm. I mean, she's not a pure sprinter. She's obviously very quick. And yeah, she's obviously good on the track as well. She rode the Berlin 6, or the women's version of the Berlin 6, against Katie Archibald, who we
and
heard
won
from earlier. And won. And, you know, to beat Katie Archibald shows that she's a serious caliber rider. You're about the same age, Abby. I mean, you must look at her and be very impressed indeed.
Yeah, definitely. She's so talented rider, so strong, and like good at sprinting as well. Mm. In the end,
but you know, being in the team that she's in, and we'll hear from Anna van der Breggen next month. That's her teammate because she's moved across to Bols Dolmans as well. She's the Olympic champion, of course. You kind of forget that, don't you?
Because
you kind of forget that she's Olympic champion, but she is. That team, you know, so many. There's Garnier, there's Lizzie Dynan, there's Van der Breggen, I mean, in that team, she will have no choice but to keep her feet on the ground, I would think. She's not going to go into every race as a team leader, is she?
No, and the difficulty is with that team is something I brought up with her, just how long they will be able to balance that level of talent with the ambition of each of the individual riders. I think this season will probably be okay, but it'll be interesting to see how much longer they manage to sustain that. But I asked Amelie who the main contenders would be for the top team in the world. Abby, from the outside, how do you view Bowles Dolmans and their dominance, and who do you see as being a big contender to take over that world's best mantle?
Looking at them, I think they're a team to aspire to be like, because they are professional and they also act like a team, whereas some teams with lots of leaders and winners can sort of be individuals more than a team, but they always seem to let everyone have an opportunity and work as a team. But I think Silence, they seem pretty strong, so they could be competitive against them, because they've obviously got Kirsten and Danny King, etc. So yeah, I think they could be one to watch.
But it's difficult to see beyond Bowles Dolmans for a lot of these races. They've got riders who can excel in all terrain, really, and they did a good job last year of sharing it out a bit. You know, they all had their success. Nobody was really dominant.
Yeah, I think it would be a shame from an outside perspective if they have too much of a stranglehold over the racing, because it is nice to see a bit of a narrative. And the advantage that women's cycling has over men's cycling is that you do have a much more streamlined calendar, so you can follow each of the races quite easily, in the way that with the men's racing, you get dizzy trying to keep across everything that's happening. So it would be nice to see a little bit of competition at the top, but it is difficult to see how anyone is going to be able to win very many races over Bowles Dolmans, whoever that rider might be.
I mean, the field down under, Abby, it wasn't World Tour level, perhaps, but Aurica were very dominant. Was there anybody that caught your eye, a rider or a team? Was there anybody that caught your eye who you maybe weren't familiar with, who we should watch out for this year?
Well, I've never really thought of Aurica as that dominant as they were. Obviously, that's the peak of their season, but in the World Tour races, I've never really seen them. So I think like Amanda Spratt and people really were impressive.
Are you seeing? I know this is, you know, something that drops are trying to do, really riding as a team, is it? And you were second in the team classification, weren't you, in the Tour Down Under? Is that something we're seeing more and more? You mentioned Bowles Dolmans set the standard, really, in terms of racing as a team, but can you see more teams really going into races with a leader and with a plan?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You'll see so many more women sacrifice their own race, especially in a sprint finish. The lead out woman will just, I mean, you have to try and dodge them sometimes, but they'll just completely sacrifice their own race. And early on, people will chase back much more like the men's, which makes it more TV. Like for TV, that's much better as well, because it makes for a more exciting race. So I think, yeah, teams are coming together more to work against each other as a team. Which is
great.
Good.
Well, listen, we should wrap things up, I think, for this month, shouldn't we? Anything to add, Orla?
For once?
Searches her brain.
That's my bit done.
Her tired brain.
the coffee's run out.
Coffee's done its job. I should mention our Cycling Ramble is another podcast, a rival podcast, but they contacted us, say they've done an interview with Dame Sarah Story. Quite interesting. If you want to have a listen to that, you'll find them. Cycling Ramble, they're on iTunes, as of course are we. Talking about sexism and other things. Quite interesting. I mentioned we'll have Anna van der Breggen next month, and lots else besides, and we'll start to get some races soon as well, Orla, won't we?
I know, exciting. Can't wait for it all to get properly underway, and we'll be watching this lady beside us in Strada Bianchi with any luck, flying out the day after your birthday.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be good.
Be a quiet birthday, eh?
Yeah.
Early to bed.
Definitely.
Yeah, no celebrating, no sugar.
No.
Well, we better let you go, Abby, because you're off to help your father, the florist, who has got his shop not far from here. Very so very kind of you to go and help him the day after Valentine's
yeah,
Day.
I mean.
The day after the busiest day of the year. You've timed that just right.
She's not stupid.
Help is a strong word. I mean,
hang out.
Have lunch.
Orla has spotted you cycling through her neighborhood, I think, on your training rides. You live a little bit further in town, and so it would seem
don't go there, Richard.
It would seem logical that you might drag her along at some
point. Yeah, we should.
Drag is the operative word. Maybe we could get Richard along too.
Yeah, that'd be good. We can slipstream
behind that machine.
Oh, the articulated truck. Yeah. Well,
get a tow.
Yeah, not sure that would do you much good. I don't think that would get much speed in your legs. Do it that way. Anyway, listen, let's leave it there. Hopefully you can join us again at some point, Abby. Thank you very much for joining us today. And best of luck with the season starting at Strada Bianchi.
Thank you.
Thank you, Orla.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you very much to this week's producer, Mariana DeForge.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.